Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. It's amazing. No matter where you go in the Church of God, you just feel at home. And it's wonderful to be here with you today. We were here a couple of years ago, my wife and our kids, and we visited Disney before we went to the feast in Panama City. And so we're here again visiting, and you guys provided a hurricane for us that we survived. We stayed on the Disney Resort. I figured there would be no better place to be than right in those Disney buildings, which I assumed that they would build very strong. So we stuck it out. I'm sure everyone here was okay. Heard there was some damage on the coastline, but God surely moved that hurricane away so that we were all protected. It's very good that everyone's here today. I am here with my wife, Carol. She's in the back, and I have three children, Max, Jack, and Faith. And if we'd known about the kids' choir, we could have provided three more. That would have been a wonderful addition. I'm going to tell you just real briefly about our youngest daughter, Faith. Some of you may know her from prayer requests. Of course, we were here a couple years ago. You got to know her a little bit. You'll see her zooming around here in her wheelchair, little pink wheelchair. She's the social butterfly of our group. She doesn't seem to know an enemy. She makes friends with everyone. But some of you may know she was born with spina bifida about 4.5 years ago. So she doesn't have use of her legs. That's why she's in the wheelchair. But one of the side effects that came along with it when she started eating was she vomited all the time. And so for the past four or so years, she just vomits every day. There are some days where she doesn't, and there are some meals that she won't, but it's just a regular occurrence. So it's one of those things that we've asked on prayer requests that people would, pray for. We've been to Mayo Clinic, been to Dallas, St. Louis, Kansas City, all over the country, it seems like, trying to find out what the cause of this vomiting issue is. And to date, nothing has taken care of it. She has gone more of a week or two, I think, without it when she comes out of the hospital after some of her surgeries. So we thought maybe it was a hydration issue, so we got her a feeding tube. And she has gained some weight from that feeding tube, which is very good for her because she needed to gain the weight, but it hasn't stopped the vomiting. So I just want to give you that update so that you are aware of what's going on with her. And I don't think we've had an update for at least a year on the prayer requests. But just please keep her in your prayers. So hopefully one day that God will decide, enough is enough, and he'll stop that. Yeah. So there is a lot of stuff here on the Day of Atonement. This is one of those festivals that I remember growing up in the church thinking there wasn't much to this day other than you just fast and you just suffer through the day, and when you get to the evening then you can go eat and drink something. But there's way more to it than that. And the older I get, the longer, we in the church, we see more and more of the depth of what God has planned for us through this day. Today is the next important step in the plan of God for the salvation of mankind in the coming kingdom. The Day of Atonement is a challenging holy day. It's typically not our favorite. If I asked you what your favorite holy day was, you might say, well, it would be one that would possibly evoke the strongest emotion. It would be one where you got to go somewhere special, where you got a chance to eat out some delectable food, or you had some wonderful fellowship with some people, or something that you did. But on Atonement, while we do fellowship, we tend to keep a little bit of a distance from each other because of the bad breath that tends to go along with it. We usually don't go anywhere out of the ordinary. And there's certainly no food or drink involved. The fact is, brethren, on this day, we do nothing. We do nothing. Of all the holy days, Atonement is the one where we do nothing, meaning that nothing brings attention to us and our pleasure. Nothing comes to it for us. There's no pleasure in this for us. We don't eat, we don't drink, and we afflict ourselves, as it says in Leviticus. We deny ourselves. We deny ourselves the daily ration of food that sustains us. We deny ourselves from our earthly pleasures that entertain us. And that's why it's a challenge for us today. Because our fleshly selves want, doesn't it? It just wants. Our human bodies want, and they want all the time. And we want things, and we want to do things, we want to eat things, we want to drink things, we want to make money, we want power, we want to be right, we want notoriety, we want to be recognized, we want to be the best, we want, and we want. I'd like you to turn over to Isaiah chapter 58, if you would. So he said there's so much to this day, but what we're going to do is take just a sliver, if we can, and look to the depth of this day a little bit more, using Isaiah chapter 58 as this linchpin scripture section, and we'll branch out from there. But on this Day of Atonement, we have to forget all of our wants, and we have to cast them aside and see and do what God wants and what God desires instead of what we want and what we desire. Because when we do what God wants instead of what we want, then we live the life of the new man in Jesus Christ that we all became upon baptism. And this day really does serve as a springboard, as it were, for our spiritual life, because even though we deny ourselves and our wants today, God is going to make a statement to us through Israel that we should be denying ourselves not just today, but every day as we walk towards his kingdom in our spiritual walk. Isaiah chapter 58 and verse 3, Israel is speaking to God when they say to him, this is Israel speaking, "Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen it? Why have we humbled ourselves and you have not noticed?" See, Israel here wanted notoriety from God, didn't they? They wanted acceptance, but they wanted it in a whopper kingdom. They wanted it their own way. They wanted it the way that they wanted it. But God says, no, you can't have this in a whopper kingdom, and you can't even have it in a whopper junior kingdom. You can't have it your way, period. Because what it does is it brings about contention, and it brings about strife, and it brings about lawbreaking. You see, having it your way brings about a life that's really not worthy of my calling, he says. It brings about problems that oftentimes have far-reaching and long-lasting consequences when we do things our way. Again, you can hold your place in Isaiah chapter 58. We'll be coming back and forth to this area, but I'd like you to turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. And here in the book of Samuel, we have a conversation of sorts between Samuel and Saul, who we know is the first king of Israel. Here in 1 Samuel 15, it says this, "And Samuel said unto Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted that Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up to Egypt, or out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Don't spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Now, this may seem like a rather cruel thing that God had ordered, the destruction of every man, woman, child and animal. And this is really a topic that comes up on, if you've ever seen on blogs and posts and boards online, this is actually something that comes up by atheists to say that God's a cruel monster. We don't have time to debate the ethics here, but let me just say this. God's will is supreme. God's will is supreme. And he doesn't cast people aside with a wisp of his hand. He just doesn't do that. They will all be resurrected one day. They'll all have their opportunity here. All of these people here. If a sparrow falls to the ground, he knows what happens to these people here. But it's always God's prerogative, I should say, what he does with our lives and with everyone else's. As Job said, you know, he gives life and he takes it away. But blessed be the name of the Lord. But notice what God, Saul says here, or where it says God gave instruction to Saul. And I want you to notice what Saul did. Look at verse 9. "But Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fatted calves of the lambs and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless they devoted to destruction." And then God told Samuel what had happened in Saul and told Saul to confront Samuel about this. And so he was confronted about it. And then look in verse 15. Here's the justification of Saul. Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, from the people, spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction." And then Samuel said to Saul, "Stop, I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night." And he said to him, "Speak." Samuel said, "Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go, devote to the destruction of the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they're consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Now notice the disconnect, and see how Saul has created in his own reality, or has created his own mind, his own reality between what he was told and what he actually did. And actually, this is a glimpse, brethren, into the wavelength of the mind of Satan, creating a false reality. If we don't put on the mind of Jesus Christ, this is what will happen. Verse 20, Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. But the people took the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. So Saul was saying, in effect here, you know, look at all of these great things that I've done for the Lord. Look at all these animals now that I have to sacrifice to God that I didn't have before. Now I have all of these that I can sacrifice. Well, he should be pleased with us. Why isn't he pleased? He should bless us. But Samuel said in verse 22, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. You see, the first king of Israel, he wanted it his way. He wanted it his way. He didn't want to do what God wanted him to do. He didn't want to do it God's way. He wanted it his way. And then, after he did that, he wanted recognition from God for doing it his way. And because Saul decided to do the things that he wanted to do his way instead of God's way, the Jews then reaped the consequences of that some 500 years later. When you remember the story of Esther, when Haman the Agagite had attempted to destroy the Jews under King Xerxes. And Esther came in to save the day. Haman was an Agagite. He was a descendant of the king who Saul had allowed to live. You see, our daily choices that we make have long-lasting and far-reaching consequences and effects. So back in Isaiah chapter 58, God is saying that it's not your ways. He's saying it's my ways. My way is the way that brings peace. It's the way that brings life. Your way, it brings contention and strife. And notice how God responds to Israel in verse 3 when they ask the question of why God does not notice when they fast. I want to read here from the NIV first. Yet on the day of your fasting, you do as you please and exploit all your workers. In the King James Version, it says, behold, in the day of your fast, you find your own pleasure and exact all of your labors. You know, God calls the fast day their own because they weren't fasting out of a desire to be close to God. They weren't fasting out of desire to cast off this self-seeking, self-serving attitude and actions. They were using God, really, as a type of an idol to pay tribute so that they could get everything that they wanted. Fasting really just for a ritual to put on a show just for God. Have you ever known someone who just kind of goes through the motions of doing a job, but doesn't really put the effort and the time or the work that a good job needs into it? They're just kind of, oh. I can't imagine going into Disney World Park and saying, you know, as you walk through the gate. A lot of times, if you've ever been to Disney World, I'm sure everybody here has, they say, have a magical day. And it's always upbeat. Now, can you imagine walking through that park and they're saying, have a great day. Enjoy yourself. I mean, you said the words, have a magical day. But you don't mean it. It doesn't. There's nothing behind it. How would you like the doctor to examine you, give you a prescription, and kick you out the door? Some of them are just that way. It's as fast in, as fast as out, you can get them. Running through as quick as you possibly can. Or do you want a doctor who really listens and has your best interest at heart and is very concerned about you? There's clearly a difference. Parents, have you ever asked your kids to clean your room? Their room, I should say. There's a difference. You know if they put the effort into it. You know it. You can always tell. There's a difference. One is self-centered, while the other is very other-centered. The word labors here in Isaiah chapter 58:3 denotes unusually hard and painful labor, toil or travail. The Septuagint renders it this way: and goad all those who are under your control. Well, the idea seems to be here at the time that they were oppressive in exacting all that was due to them, and they remitted nothing and they forgave nothing. How odd it is during a time of fasting that they would be going out exacting labors, getting people to pay what was owed to them on this fast day. I think that's a strikingly odd thing to do on this fast day. Maybe they felt there was nothing else for them to do that day, and there really shouldn't have been. It was a day to do nothing, but they decided to fill up their time with filling their coffers full of money by oppressing those who were already being oppressed by them. They want, and they want, and they want. Notice then in verse 4 the outcome of this insatiable cupidity. Verse 4, your fasting ends in quarreling and strife and in striking each other with wicked fists. You cannot fast as you do today and expect your voice to be heard on high. And this was the outcome of their fast. He goes on to say, is this the kind of fast that I have chosen? God is saying, only a day for a people to humble themselves? Is it only for bowing one's head like a reed and for lying in the sackcloth and ashes? Is that what you call a fast? A day acceptable to the Lord? Wow, there's a lot in that verse. There's really a lot of information in that verse. This section, maybe more than any other in the Bible, ought to expand our minds about what this fast day is all about. Is fasting about humility and lowliness of mind and affliction, brethren? Yes. Yes, it is. But if all you do today is put your time in on this fast, and that's it, then you will get nothing out of this day. Because all you have done is you focused on yourself and considered, how do I make it through this day of fasting? And when I say yourself, I'm speaking of the old fleshly remnant, that old man. There is something that should be gained for the new man, for that new man that is tuned into the wavelength of God, the new man that God is molding and shaping and growing to be born into the family of God. You see, forsaking food and water as a gesture is really useless unless something is added to it. God asks the question, is this an acceptable day of the Lord? I think we should all ask ourselves that same question. Is this an acceptable day unto the Lord? Under these circumstances that we're reading here, the obvious answer is no, it's not. It's not an acceptable day to the Lord. So if it's not acceptable to just go through the motions, then what is acceptable to the Lord? I want you to look in verse 6. Look at the fast that God desires. There are four things we're going to go through here. Verse 6, is not this the kind of fasting that I have chosen? Number one is this, to loose the bonds of wickedness. This is what he wants, to loose the bonds of wickedness. God is using imagery here that the children of Israel should be very familiar with. One of the great stories of their ancestors was told in the festival of the Passover each year. How the children of Israel were saved from the bonds of wickedness and the sin in Egypt. And today we understand this imagery as well from the example of Israel in Egypt, but also with a physical example, I should say, that pointed to a spiritual battle that we face. You see, for us, brethren, one of the most powerful things that holds us from spiritual progress is bondage. That's one of the things that keeps us down. In the scriptures, there's a number of references that refers to that bondage as cords, as bands, as chains. There's also slavery, yoke, and captivity. And all of these kinds of bondage can be seen in the old sinful patterns, the old sinful actions and behaviors and addictive behaviors that we have. And it's not surprising that when we feel the need to make a change in our lives and allow the Lord to lead us into new patterns, behaviors or actions, that it's very difficult and challenging, and it's often met with frustration and failure. And then we find ourselves back again where we started. We wanted to make those changes, and we move back into those old habits and those old behaviors. You ever wondered why that is? You ever wondered why it's so easy to go back and to not go forward? I want you to consider the example of Israel as they were leaving Egypt. We won't turn there just for sake of time, although I do have a captive audience here. You have nowhere to go. Oh, we're trying to break off captivity, so I won't do that. But do you remember the story in Egypt when the Israelites had left Ramses and they traveled by night and they reached that place called Pi-Hahiroth, and they had between them Migdol and the sea, and they were kind of boxed in. Do you remember that story? And they were completely surrounded now, and the armies of the Pharaoh came down upon them because he'd heard they were boxed in. And they began to cry out, saying, "Why have you taken us away to the wilderness to die? It would have been better to serve for us to remain in Egypt and serve the Egyptians. It's better to go back to Egypt." You see, waiting on the Lord in His time is not always an easy thing for us to do. But at the last minute, we know that God opened the way. And He opened the Red Sea so that they could be saved from that disaster. You see, for us today, when we make changes that are for the good, it's often difficult because it's uncomfortable for us. It's very uncomfortable for us. It's different and it's challenging. And Satan's wavelength is always broadcasting his influence in this world. And the old fleshly part that we have left is tuned in to that wavelength. And the challenge then is overcoming that influence that pulls us back into that area of life that we are used to, that area of life that those old man's clothes, as I like to call it, are accustomed to. And we get pulled back into that. And Satan knows that. And this is the spiritual battle that we face. And this is why we often find ourselves falling back into our old habits, because the comforts of sin are deceptive. And it draws us back when we face any challenges or difficulties in our lives. The children of Israel wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to go back to captivity. You know, there's a physiological truth to this as well. The battle to break the bonds of wickedness is really being waged between the synapses in our brains. It's a battle of the mind. Synapses are really just the connections of the nerve pathways. Or I should say the nerves that make up pathways. So you have a nerve and a nerve, and the synapses are just that space that allows that neurotransmitter to go from one nerve to the other. And when you have a continuous succession of those, you have a nerve pathway. And this really is the activity in our minds that's crucial for biological computation of perception and thought. You see, when you were born, brethren, many of your pathways were already genetically predetermined. They were there. You had what you had. They were there. Now, a lot of them die off when you're born immediately. But there are genetic predetermined pathways that you have. And it didn't come from outside influence. It's really just what your mommy and your daddy gave you. That's what you had. But then there are things that happen to us in the environment. And you begin to grow. You know, there's one study I was just reading recently, I think it was this week or last week, and they had said in this study that the mother is the primary driver of intelligence in their children. They found the genes of their mother in the cortex. This is where primary thought and behavioral actions take place. For the men, for the fathers, they found that the primary modus of the gene was in the baser instincts. Things that had to do with food, sex, aggression. But they found that the final product was about 60% genetic and 40% environment. So you see, environment has a very large part to play in this. so many of the pathways in our brain that make us what we are today in terms of our behavior, our attitudes, and our habits are learned. They're absolutely learned. It's the influences around us that can make new pathways and stop the old pathways from being fired up, basically. You see, everything we do, from movement to behaviors to actions to habits, are created from the repetitious use of neural pathways. And the more that we use them, the more ingrained they become. And the more worn they are, the deeper that path and the deeper that rut gets, and the easier it is to activate and to use them. Let me give you a crude example, if I can. I don't mean my crude. I mean, it's just a sort of a base elementary example of this. A couple of years ago, I had decided, you know what? 50 is right around the corner. I need to start doing something about my health. I wasn't particularly overweight, but I was a little heavier than I like to be. And one of the things that I loved to do was I loved to get a 44-ounce soda at the convenience store down the road. Had to have it every day at around 1:30 because I just got ingrained in that habit. And I craved that sweet, fizzy taste of that Coke. And I just, you know, I go out and I go to the bank and I drop the checks off and I go to the convenience store and I come back and then I would suck on that Coke the entire afternoon to get through work. Now, I knew it was doing to my body, though. I knew I was getting an insulin rush. I knew it was going to be bad for me as far as maybe getting diabetes one day or pre-diabetic. I knew it was bad for my belly fat. I knew it was bad for my heart. I just knew all of these things were not good for me. So I decided I need to make a change. And so I did. I said, I started working out more and I started saying, you know, I'm not going to drink Coke in the afternoon. I'm going to try and break that habit. And here's what I found. I found at the beginning, it was very challenging for me to stay at the office and to not go out and get that 44-ounce soda. And I would just tug, and I had to have coworkers tell me, no, just stay here, you'll get over it. So I had to have that help. Because I had that very deep and well-established pathway for getting Coke at 1:30 in the afternoon. I just had to have it. After about 1 to 2 months, that craving began to disappear as that new pathway was laid down. And I started following that new pathway of not going to the convenience store. But here's what I noticed. That even a year later, that when I would go to the bank, and if I wasn't consciously thinking about going back to the office, I would drive by the convenience store and I would almost pull in. Or I actually did pull in one day. And I drove back out. And it was almost an instinct that it just happened that way. That old pattern was still there. And it was still active, but I had to make sure I had the new pattern that would suppress the old one. Until I had created another pathway for the bank and for home that was deeply rooted, that was deeply engraved, I couldn't break that old one. You see, the old pathways are still there, folks. Motor pathways simply don't go away. You haven't ridden a bike for 40 years. You could jump on a bike and ride it again. That old pathway is still there. You see, you have to write a new one to use instead of the old one. Research suggests that it takes about 66 days to overcome old habits. But the way that they're overcome is to create new ones in order to replace the old ones. Because the brain, it loves stimulation. And if the brain is stimulated by a new route, it will crave, if it's not stimulated by the new route, it's going to crave the old ones. That's what will happen. And Satan knows this. He knows it, and he uses it against us to do the things that we don't want to do. Paul talked about that. Apostle Paul didn't just say to overcome evil. He said to overcome evil with good. And fasting is a tool that God has given us to break the bonds of wickedness that strangle us, because it removes the shackling to sinful behaviors and can absolutely guarantee liberty. So if you're addicted to bad behavior, or, you know, such as ungodly anger, I'm sure everybody has, I take that back, I'm sure there's somebody that has a problem with anger out of all this room. At some point in your life, or if it's foul speech, or if it's rudeness, or if it's unkindness, or if it's sloth or gluttony, or even drugs or adultery or pornography, fasting can break the bonds of this wickedness. And these are all the things that the natural man loves to do, but the godly man in us eschews, doesn't want to do it. There are prices to pay for the wickedness that we're steeped in. There are heavy burdens that come with it. And that's why God says the second thing that fasting is for is to undo the heavy burdens. Undo the heavy burdens. Sin brings about great burdens in our lives. There's a heavy mental toll that weighs on us. And a burden, brethren, is simply a weight. That's what a burden is. It's just a weight that we have to carry around with us. And while you and I may be able to carry a weight around for a period of time, we cannot carry a heavy weight before too long, before it just breaks us down and it takes its toll on us. Look at Psalm chapter 38, if you would. This is a psalm that David had written. Psalm chapter 38, David here gives a really good description of how the burden of sin can affect us all. Psalm chapter 38, and let's look at verse 1. A psalm of David to bring to remembrance. O Lord, rebuke me not in your wrath, neither chasten me in your hot displeasure. For your arrows stick fast in me, and your hand presses me sore. There is no soundness in my flesh of thine anger, neither is there any rest in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities are gone over my head. As a heavy burden, they are too heavy for me. Because the burden of the weight of sin is so great, you kind of get the image here of, you know, in verse 4, of the weight being so heavy that it's drowning him, and he just simply cannot stay above the water. Yes, there's a great penalty that comes with sin. Of course, we all know Romans 6:23, that the wages of sin, there's a wage for sin, and that's death. Those are the wages. The burden is very, very great. The Septuagint renders the verse in Isaiah 58, we can go back there, this way. Isaiah 58, it says this, dissolve the obligations of violent contracts. Now, this could refer to the contracts they undertook at the time that were far too burdensome for them, as they would have been dissolved at the time of Jubilee on this Day of Atonement. But in the far more important spiritual sense, this shows the dissolving of the burden of death and the consequences that sin exacts on us spiritually through the acceptance of Jesus Christ as our Savior at baptism. Now, there are physical consequences to sin that God didn't necessarily say that he would remove from us. And sometimes those are things we have to carry. But God says, or Jesus said, I will carry those for you. I can do that. You see, fasting shows us the weakness in this human flesh. And I'm sure we're all feeling some sort of weakness by this time, some 18 to 19 hours into this fast. It exposes how frail we are in this flesh, and it calls us to cast our cares and concerns and guilt and the weight that does so easily beset us on Jesus. That's what he said he wanted to do for us. He bore our infirmities and weaknesses to the death of the cross. Look over in Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. Jesus is calling on us to give up the burden that weighs us down. And he says to cast it upon him. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 28. You see, frankly, this is the way out that thankfully Jesus provided for us. Matthew 11, 28. Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You see, the guilt of sin is a great thing to bear. And so is the weight of caring for the things in this life as well. And it might be the burden of caring for someone who can't care for themselves. Maybe you have a relative or a friend, someone that is elderly, someone that is sick, someone that's a relative that you care for that cannot care for themselves. It might be caring for the needs of a widow or a widower. These are things that we absolutely should be doing, all the while casting our burdens upon Jesus, knowing that it is Him who gives us the ability to care for them, but knowing that ultimately it's God who has allowed this position to occur for them, for you, and believing that you can do and you will do your best to care for whoever it needs to be cared for. But ultimately, it's in God's hands, whether that person lives or dies or thrives or flourishes or doesn't. And that is the burden that we have to put onto Him, that He wants to care for us. God doesn't want us to be overly anxious about things or the basic necessities of life. But Matthew 6 tells us, for instance, what to put on, what to eat, what to drink. Those things we don't be concerned about. When these burdens are removed, when that happens, then the oppressed can go free. And that's the next thing He tells us. He said, let the oppressed go free. Let him go free. Look over in Leviticus. Look over in Leviticus chapter 23. The Day of Atonement is the time of Jubilee. It's the year of release. It was a time, if Israel actually followed it, we have no evidence they actually followed the year of Jubilee year, but it would release all peoples from their debts, and land lost would go back to their families. Look in Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 9. Then shall you cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement shall you make the trumpet sound throughout all of your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. And it shall be a Jubilee unto you, and you shall return every man unto his possession, and you shall return every man unto his family. Referring to indentured servants. Jubilee, fasting, and atonement was a reminder to the children of Israel not to oppress others the way that sin oppresses us. Yet when you consider the history of Israel, what was it like? It really was oppression. It was oppressing the poor. It was oppressing the widows. It was not returning the land. It was not granting liberty. Zechariah also mentions this in Zechariah chapter 7. But they had failed to learn the atonement lesson of letting the oppressed go free. They didn't do that. Hence, we see what we see here in Isaiah chapter 58. Another way that they and we too today can be oppressive is to be unmerciful. Unmerciful and unforgiving. In fact, mercy is one of the major themes of atonement. One of the major themes of atonement. Turn over to Exodus. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 32. Here in Exodus chapter 32, we have the children of Israel wondering what was taking Moses so long to come down from the mountain from communing with God. And God had just written the Ten Commandments on the tablets, and now the children of Israel thought that, well, maybe he died, maybe he left. They didn't know what had come of him. So they got together, and they decided to have Aaron fashion them a golden calf. And we see them falling back into that old pathway of sin again, back into that usual way, that which they were accustomed to and were so comfortable with. And so they fashioned a golden calf, and they had a naked orgy in their worshiping this golden idol, debauchery. And God's wrath became very hot, as if to destroy them. But instead, he sent Moses down to deal with them. And of course, we know the story of how he broke the tablets in anger, and he melted the golden calf down, and he put it in the water, and he made them drink the bitter water. And then he called the people to choose sides. Pick the Lord's side, or you can pick your own side. And of those that chose their own side, they were killed by the sword. And those who were left, notice what Moses says in Exodus chapter 32 and verse 29. For Moses had said, consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day. And it shall come to pass on the morrow that Moses said unto the people, you have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up unto the Lord. Peradventure, I shall make an atonement for your sin. Because of what they did, Moses said he was going up to make atonement for their sin. And in Exodus chapter 34, just a couple of chapters over, we see Moses again on the mountain. And Moses is again with God receiving the new copy of the Ten Commandments. And notice in verse 5. And the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed by before him and proclaimed the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. He didn't destroy him because he was so gracious, as he said he was going to be to his people. And in verse 28, so he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, and he did not eat bread and he did not drink water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And so this, I believe, was on atonement that the second set of the commandments were given to him. And the end of the 40 days of fasting was on the Day of Atonement. And this 40-day period that Moses fasted corresponds to the Hebrew calendar of Elul 1 through Tishri 10. That's the 40-day period of what the Jews today call Teshuvah. It is a time of repentance. It is a time of turning back to God, the way they look at it, which I think is absolutely correct. And it corresponds to the time that the children of Israel were supposed to be repenting of the sin that they had committed before. And then the last 10 days from Tishri 1 to 10 is called the Yamin Noraim, which is the awesome days or the days of awe. And you may have seen Mr. Kubik had written something up on this recently. But this was a time of deep introspection, of looking at their sins that they had committed and saying, what can I do differently? How do I change? So these last 10 days, we are within the days of awe. This is the last day of the days of awe on this Day of Atonement. This deep time of looking back and saying, what can I do differently for next year so that our names can continue to be inscribed in the book of life? But this whole idea of mercy, we see here, we see it throughout Scripture. God passes before Moses. He's not destroyed because of God's mercy. The children of Israel are not consumed because of God's mercy. The high priest went into the Holy of Holies on atonement to sprinkle blood on the mercy seat for the sins of the children of Israel. And of course, we are told to be merciful to others. As Matthew chapter 6 says, he tells us in the Lord's Prayer to forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And again, in Luke 6, he tells us to be merciful to others as our Father is merciful to us. So yes, being merciful, forgiving, and forbearing is letting the oppressed go free. And the last one he shows here is to break every yoke. To break every yoke. Now, if you're not familiar with a yoke, it's not the yellow part of an egg. It's not the yoke we're talking about here. No, a yoke is a board or a bone or something that's stiff and solid like that, that would tie one ox to the other. Now, if you're younger, you may not know this as much as if you're older. If you grew up on a farm, you would know this very, very well. You would tie those two animals together so that they, when they pulled, they would move together in unison because two does more work than one. The problem with a yoke here is that it ties us to sin. And when sin moves, it moves us as well. It makes us act, and we move with it, and also almost makes it impossible to resist its tug. And Satan then can control the yoke to move us wherever he wants at his will. And that's what happened with the yoke when they tied the oxen together. You move one, you move the other. You move one, you move the other. You keep them going wherever you want them to go. I want you to notice what fasting does for the body physically by breaking down the yoke in the body. It breaks down the old, it loosens the bonds and breaks the physical yoke on the body. I want to read something from the Telegraph newspaper here. This is from June 2014, written by Sarah Napton. And I'll read just a portion of this. She writes this: fasting for as little as 3 days can regenerate the entire immune system. Even in the elderly, scientists have found in a breakthrough described as remarkable. New research suggests starving the body kickstarts stem cells into producing new white blood cells, which fight off infection. Scientists at the University of Southern California say the discovery could be particularly beneficial for people suffering from damaged immune systems, such as cancer patients and chemotherapy. It could also help the elderly whose immune system becomes less effective as they age, making it harder for them to fight off even common diseases. The researchers say fasting flips a regenerative switch which prompts stem cells to create brand new white blood cells, essentially regenerating the entire immune system. It gives the okay for stem cells to go ahead and begin proliferating and rebuild the entire system, says Professor Walter Lengo, professor of gerontology and biological sciences at the University of California. And the good news is that the body got rid of the parts of the system that might be damaged or old, the inefficient parts during the fasting. Now, if you start with a system heavily damaged by chemotherapy or aging, fasting cycles can generate literally a new immune system. Prolonged fasting forces the body to use stores of glucose and fat, but also breaks down a significant portion of white blood cells. During each cycle of fasting, this depletion of white blood cells induces changes that trigger stem cell-based regeneration of the new immune system cells. In trials, humans were asked to regularly fast for between 2 and 4 days over a 6-month period. Scientists found that prolonged fasting also reduces the enzyme PKA, which is linked to aging, and a hormone which increases cancer risk and tumor growth. We could not predict that prolonged fasting would have such a remarkable effect in promoting stem cell-based regeneration of the hematopoietic system. When you starve, the system tries to save energy, and one of the things it can do to save energy is to recycle a lot of the immune cells that are not needed, especially those that may be damaged. This is a remarkable thing. You may have seen this a couple of years ago. They also found the same thing in people with multiple sclerosis, which is an autoimmune disorder, that it resets the immune system and helps them tremendously. So from a physical perspective, fasting renews the body. As parts of the body die, newness arises and gives life and protection from the ravages of the environment. It breaks the physical yoke of what's keeping the body from being healthy. Spiritually, fasting will do the same thing. It can root out the pride, the anger, the self-importance, and anything that is yoking us to sin. And the yoke is broken when we seek God in it and take His yoke upon us. As we unyoke to sin and yoke up to Jesus, then we let Him lead us, and we let Him move us, and we let Him pull us, and we move wherever He wants us to move. And it's not a burden. He says His burden is light. His yoke is easy. And that is because His commandments bring about life-changing realities for us. All of these ideas are life-changing, brethren. And God is saying, listen, you shouldn't fast and take from others. It's not for what you can get. You shouldn't fast just to receive credit from me, God says. This fast is to produce something. There's a reason for it beyond the fact that God says to do it. There's something very deep and profound that we need to learn from this day as we fast. There are things that you receive from this fast. There are things that are essential for the new man. It's the removal of the ideas and the attitudes and the habits so that they don't easily beset us and they don't drag us down, so that we can get on to do something greater in the work of God. So despite it looking like it, this type of fast has nothing to do with what you want. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do then with what we can do for others by following these instructions, and what we can do for others by removing the hindrances from us, so that we can then extend God's mercy and His kindness and all of those wonderful attributes that He bestows upon us to bestow upon others as well. So stop focusing on how hungry you are and start thinking about all the other people in the world who go without food every day. And there are millions of them. There are millions of them who go hungry all the time. What are the fruits that God says should result from this fast? Look at verse 7. Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood? Now, contrary to society back then, we don't tend to see a lot of poor people wandering around the streets. We don't see a lot of naked people wandering around the streets that need clothing. But it doesn't mean there are not still those people that have those needs. There are. There are plenty of people that have those needs. And there are ways that you can go about to help them. God never tells us to not be involved in helping people that need this help. Be involved. Do something. Are we hiding ourselves from the needs of others? You know, there's a circle of care that Paul talks about that begins with care for our nuclear family first, then our extended family, and it moves on out into the church and then into the world. So it starts at the beginning here. How do you take care of your family? How do you take care of your extended family? Are you doing those things? Don't withhold yourself from them or from your church family, your spiritual family. Don't withhold good things from them. Search out those who need help and help them. And then look at what happens when we stop with all of our wants and we focus on others' needs. Look at verse 8. Then your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help, and He will say, "Here am I." If you do away with the yoke of oppression and the pointing finger and malicious talk, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness, and your night will be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you always. He will satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame. And you will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring that waters, whose waters never fail. Notice that He will satisfy your needs. You see, the brethren, the great paradox in life is that if you give yourself away, you'll never lack for anything. See, the next step in the Holy Day plan is the Feast of Tabernacles. It's the 1,000-year millennial reign of Christ that will bring peace, it'll bring joy, it'll bring abundance to the people of the earth. But this peace and this joy and this abundance just doesn't happen through fiat. It just doesn't occur out of nothing. There's a reason. It doesn't even come from Christ's presence alone. It comes from overcoming evil with good. It comes from binding Satan. The day that this picture is the binding of Satan. Binding Satan in this world, binding Satan in our lives, and replacing him with the rule of Christ. As we do today, if you're baptized, and as we look forward to in the kingdom of tomorrow. Christ will rule. And when that happens, the people in this world will be happy because they follow the laws that brings about happiness, that brings about a joy, and brings about abundance because they follow the Ten Commandments. They follow those laws. And the natural outcome of following those laws are these things: to loosen the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke. You see, this atonement, I would like all of us to take a new step forward this year and stop thinking about the things that we want. Don't think about our hunger. Don't think about those things that are oppressing us. And don't dwell on our burdens. But consider what I can do for others, how I can bear the burden of someone else, what I can do for my family or my friends or my neighbors. How can my light break forth to glorify God and His word? How appropriate that we consider this before we leave for the feast, a time that pictures this abundance, because for that abundant living to occur, we have to learn the lessons from this day on atonement. So let's all ask ourselves, what is it that I can do this year to make next year the best year to come for someone else? And you just might find that atonement becomes your favorite holy day. Hope you all have a wonderful feast.